The following is a presentation offered by Patristic Nectar Publications, a nonprofit organization committed to nourishing the spiritually thirsty with the sweet teachings of the Holy Fathers. If you would like more information on Patristic Nectar Publications, or if you would like to see other available titles, please visit our website at www.patristicnectar.org. Again, that's www.patristicnectar.org. We thank you for inviting us to be a part of your spiritual quest, and we hope that this listening experience will be an edifying one.
Mother has agreed to the topic being Christian life under Islam and the rise of Sharia in Western society. And I want to give you just a short introduction to those words so that you can understand what we're talking about. And then just a short, maybe a half hour discussion, leaving, if it's all right with her, some time we can have questions and answers. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. You will all remember that the Islamic prophet Muhammad was born in 570. He established a religion that would become, and is to this day, a major force in the world. And it was a force that altered Christianity fundamentally, and continues to do so to this very day. The rise of Islam and the emergence out of the Arabian Peninsula of the Muslim warriors radically changed the Christian Empire, took from us the vast majority of our lands, and those lands have been under Muslim domination to this day. I want to give you just a survey of what life has been like for Christians in general under Islamic rule, not highlighting kind of the exceptions, but giving you more of kind of the basic. What are the basic contours of Christian life under Islam? Recognizing that what I'm describing is kind of their normative teaching with regards to relationship to Christians in their kingdoms, and that sometimes it's been better for us and sometimes it's been worse for us, depending where we were and who exactly was ruling the Muslim empires, who were the caliphs, etc. The word Sharia, which is our specific focus, is a word to describe a collection of Islamic law, both drawn from the Quran, their holy book, which is a book of words that were from Muhammad that he considered to be given to him by inspiration and for God's people, and also from the Hadith and the Sunnah, which are collections of teachings about Muhammad's life that were made in great detail and in massive quantities. It's a huge corpus. All of these together have led to a code, a codification of Islamic teaching about how authentic Muslim life should be lived. It's a dear subject to all Muslims. It's the essence of Islam. You can't think of Islam without Sharia. There is no such thing as Islam without Sharia. It's of the very essence. We have become aware of Sharia laws through several means. First, our awakening to the reality of Islam in the modern world, at least since 9/11. Americans have come alive. A non-stop flood of books about Islam have been pouring off of presses in this country and selling in stores. And in many bookstores, the Quran has sold more than the Bible since 9/11, which is a shock, since the Bible continues to be the number one published and read book, even though it's not being published as much in America as it is in China, which is an interesting reality these days. We have become aware very much of Islam, and especially of a particular type of Islam which fuels aggressive terrorism. At the same time, we have established relationships with Muslims who have come to our lands. Islamic immigration has really kicked up in the Western societies, especially in Western Europe, much more so than in America. And those Muslims who are now British Muslims or French Muslims, etc., many Muslims from North Africa have come to Britain because of their colonial connections. Many Muslims from Turkey have come to Germany and France, a lot of Algerians in France. These large minority groups have made requests of their governments and their new home countries that they have independent, parallel legal courts that are based upon the rulings of their sacred books. According to Sharia law, they don't want to be judged by Western secular law, and law that has its roots in Christianity, which may not necessarily line up with their own tradition. This has happened very consistently, but in the last 2 years it's become quite controversial. Especially there was a lot of press around a speech that the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, gave to the House of Lords within this last year, within the last 12 months, in which he recommended to the rulers of Britain to comply with this request. And there are already certain portions of Britain where Sharia law is normative. And for certain issues, especially issues of marriage and divorce and property conflicts, especially in the Muslim areas of Britain. And there are distinct ethnic areas in Great Britain that are almost exclusively Muslim, and frankly, that non-Muslims don't visit very comfortably. Portions of London itself, and then in Bradford and around Birmingham and places like that. Sweden and Canada have also made some moves to accommodate Sharia law and to the request of Muslim immigrants into those countries for Sharia. And just very recently, as our economy has been collapsing and we've been going into this terrible recession, there has been a request from America's Muslim community to set up certain investment structures that are in compliance with Muslim law, that won't be entangled with usury, which is strictly against Islamic teaching. And so this has often been a predecessor of something that would go a forerunner of the larger Islamic request to be treated on a broader basis and judged according to their own laws and not according to the laws of their country. So for those reasons, for all of these things that have happened to us in the last 10 years, we're thinking a lot more about Islam and our relationship to Islam, and no one has more experience with that than the Orthodox community. Eastern Christians have lived in and with Muslims for 14 centuries. We've been through the good times, we've been through the bad times, these relationships still exist, and we can be, if we're willing, a good resource for Americans to have a mature judgment about what life with Islam as a minority is, and also what life with Islam as a majority is. So let me speak a bit more about that. First, a few comments about the Muslim request in the West for their own courts. I want to say up front that I think this is a perfectly natural request. I think it's a very understandable and natural request for Muslims to want to be judged by their own laws. Remember that the Muslim does not have a worldview about society and about government that we Christians do. Muhammad never taught anything like render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's, as our Savior did in his wisdom. For Muslim, Islam is politics or it's nothing at all. There is absolutely no distinction between church and state, so to speak. Of course, Muslims don't believe in church. They don't believe in a hierarchy. They don't believe in a priesthood. They don't believe in monasticism or anything of the sort on principle. But Muslims do not view society in these typical Western ways today, where you have church and state, and the two with very kind of clear separations. Whereas traditional Christians do have those concepts. That doesn't mean that we are supportive of the current craziness in our society, where religion has almost no part in the public square, and we're afraid to even open our mouths in this country and suggest that the Bible might have something to say about government. We're very afraid of doing that because we're wimps. But even though that's the case, we do have a very clear and traditional distinction in our sacred scriptures and in the life of the church between the role of government and the role of the church. Take, for instance, the teaching of Emperor Justinian, one of our great emperor saints. who was very, very interested in applying the scriptures to society. Under his imperial reign, which I think was from 527 to 565, under that period, he oversaw a revision of Roman law. The Justinianic Code became fundamental for the development of all Christian empires in the West. And he taught very clearly that there was a difference between what he called the imperium and the sacerdotium. The imperium was the political power. This was the emperor's government. And then there was the sacerdotium, which was the priestly power, and this was the realm of the church. These had different areas of responsibility, and in his mind, they were united under God. They both were under God. The Lord had plenty to say about both areas, so he didn't view the imperium as somehow detached from inspiration and from God. Not at all. As a matter of fact, following Justinian, we have in Byzantine law and Orthodox Church law something called a nomocanon. A nomocanon is from two Greek words, nomos, which means law, and has an interpretation specifically for the civil area, and the canons of the church, which are laws that govern the church itself. These two were fused in much of our civil codes because that's how close the laws were. We would often have one book of the normal canons that was kind of a handbook for junior judicial officials so that they could refer to them and see, well, exactly what the Lord would have to say about dealing with this property, this inheritance conflict, or what have you. Even though the relationships were very close, they were distinct. No such distinction exists in Islam. The late Iranian Ayatollah Khomeini made it very clear. I quoted him earlier without giving him credit. If Islam is not politics, it's nothing at all. So you can imagine, for a Muslim here, where they make their judgment about whether Islam is true and being applied to society is very much in the courts, very much upon what law is being enforced in society. Where a Christian might make judgments from a more interior perspective, Islam is very externalized as a religion. The movements within Islam that have given a lot of attention to the heart are those movements that have been deeply affected by Christianity and by the intermeshing of Christianity and Islam. Islam itself as a religion is extremely simplistic and extremely external. So all of that is to say, we shouldn't be too surprised. If a Muslim wasn't interested in having Islamic law in society, they wouldn't be interested in their religion at all. I think the greater surprise is not that Muslims are in the West are asking to have their own Muslim courts. The greater surprise is that Christians in the West would care so little about having their religion influence the law codes. I think that's the much greater surprise than that Muslims who are here would do that. In Islam, it's taught that the whole world can be divided into two segments. Of course, we Christians do that too, right? What are our two segments? Believers and unbelievers, that's a good division, right? That those places that have been evangelized, those places where the church is established, and those places that we have yet to reach. This is a very typical distinction for us. Our calling is to make the whole world, to baptize the whole universe, to bring everyone into a relationship with Jesus Christ, to become a member of the church. This is a fundamental Christian worldview, to see the world in two ways. Muslims do also. The Islamic teaching is that there is the house of Islam. This is where the Sharia is practiced. And then there's another house, which is that area where Islam does not influence. What's that called?
House of War.
The house of war. Exactly. The house of Islam and the house of war. That tells you something very clearly about the Islamic perspective, about how to understand societies, even Christian and Jewish societies, that are outside the reign of Islam. This is where fighting and war takes place. Until such a time as the society formally bows its head, it still may be a majority Christian or a majority Persian, but until the society bows its head, once it does that, which is expressed externally by the paying of tax and by submission to Sharia law, it remains outside of the dominion of Islam. Once it does that, it becomes a part of the house of Islam. Muslims are not supposed to leave the house of Islam without a very good reason. Most of the immigration that has taken place to America and to Western Europe has not been blessed by Muslim jurists. It's something that has been done, very much like our forefathers coming to this country, for other reasons, for economic reasons, but it's been viewed very questionably. And therefore, teachers back home, so to speak, are quick to teach American Muslims, look, all right, we're going to tolerate you going to a land in which the Sharia is not taught, but you better get it done quickly. If you would go on the web, for instance, and research some of the fundamental Muslim organizations in America, there are many of them, and they're very organized, and they're very similar to us in size and influence, too. There's about the same number of mosques, around 2,000 mosques in the United States, about the exact same number of Orthodox churches. And it'd be nice to, over the years, watch the parallel. The Sunni and Shia in this country, though they have huge divisions, have bridged those divisions in order to cooperate on educational plans, to get Islamic Awareness Week in public schools, to get Islamic curriculum taught, to make sure that Fridays the Islamic children are let out of school so that they can go to the mosque, and many other things. They're cooperating tremendously together, while we Orthodox languish in our unorthodox jurisdictionalism, which is just a pathetic shame and a reproach to the name of Christ. I think it'll be interesting to watch those movements and to see who has a more successful approach to the influencing America. Muslims who have come to this country are making up, so to speak, for their questionable decisions to leave the house of Islam and to come to a place that's not ruled by Muslims by being very quick to do everything that they can in their society to return them to a state of normality. And a state of normality for a Muslim is no longer to be judged by a non-Muslim. That's not acceptable. But to be judged in their own courts by someone who reveres their own scriptures and will make judgments according to the will of God in their mind. And that will of God is expressed in the Sharia. This next point I'd like to make is that the rise of Islamic courts today and the proposal for them in America are taking advantage of a tremendous collapse in the faith of Western societies, and especially in America as well, where we live. We have tremendous consequences, and the bold request for Sharia is one of the consequences of our elite's embarrassment about being a Christian nation and our progressive abandonment of Judeo-Christian law in America. There are essentially two fundamental worldviews that are in conflict in our own land about our own self-identity. One of these worldviews is expressed very articulately by a woman scholar. Her name is Dr. Diana Eck. She's a professor of religion and Indian studies at Harvard University. Very intelligent woman. She's also the director of the Pluralism Project. She was honored by the late, our former president, Bill Clinton, in 1998. He bestowed the National Humanities Medal upon her for her work. And she has a very famous book called A New Religious America, How a Christian Country Has Become the Most Religiously Diverse Nation in the World. This is her text, a very fascinating text, in which she surveys the non-Christian religious movements and traces their growth and their numbers, and basically shows how they're Americanizing and growing and receiving a very friendly welcome here in America. The theme of the book is that we no longer can assume that America is a Christian nation, because look at this group and that group and this group and that group. The only group she doesn't survey are the Christians in America. Every other group is surveyed to make the point that we are not only not a Christian nation any longer, but that we are the most religiously pluralistic society in the world, which we are. She makes that point very strongly. The conclusion that she suggests in her book is that we Christians have to change our minds about what we want now. We should desire a government that treats every religion equally and that offers the same prerogatives, because this is the only thing that's consistent with our own democratic principles. And we have to recognize the time of Christian hegemony is over. That's one worldview. A conflicting worldview that's articulated, interestingly, by another Harvard professor, the late Samuel Huntington. Many of you probably have read his book, The Clash of Civilizations, which became a kind of a popular phrase in this whole conflict with terrorism. But he was a sociologist from Harvard who thoroughly and completely rejected his colleague Diana Eck's interpretation of America at the moment and America's self-identity. His book, which is entitled Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity, takes on the Ecks of the world. And he points out, in fact, that immigration since 1965, you should know, in 1965, the Western world radically altered our immigration standards, both in America and in Western Europe. We used to have religious quotas. People, it was assumed that the religion of an immigrant was very important for their being able to acclimate to a society. You would think it's a pretty common sense idea. We had religious quotas, so non-Christians and non-Jews who were going to come to the West, we only let so many in. That was all wiped away. And therefore, the opportunities for non-Christians from traditionally non-Christian lands to come to the West just exploded. In America, however, most of the people that came here are those who are geographically closest to us. We have the greatest proportion of our immigrants since 1965 are Latin American. They're coming up from traditionally Christian lands, at least for the last five centuries. Western Europe has not been the case, as I mentioned to you. How many Pakistanis are there and Iraqis are there in Britain? How many Turks are there in Germany? How many North Africans are there in France? These are the people that came to those countries as a response to the changing of the immigration laws. He points out that because of that, we can't take what's happening in Europe, and we can't therefore just say this is the same in America. And he points out that, in fact, makes a great argument, that if we're going to go statistically by individual self-identification, that is, what will a person say he is religiously if asked, you can make a very good argument that America has never been more Christian than today. Regardless of all the immigration that has taken place and all the pluralism, which is true, nevertheless, more than 80% of Americans self-identify as Christians. And he argues there's never been a time in the history of America when you had that high number. Therefore, far from saying that we should just say we're not a Christian nation because we have so many of these groups exist here because, his argument is these groups exist because we're a Christian nation. And that their presence here does not demand from America the response that they all needed to be treated equally before the law, as though religion had absolutely nothing to do with the creation of American society. And therefore, every religion should be able to compete. These two worldviews, the Eck and the Huntington worldview, are fighting each other. And in general, our political elite have bought off on number one. Diana Eck's worldview, this is the worldview our current president articulated, even in her language, believe it or not. In his inaugural speech, he used her, very typical phrases that she's the mother of, making it very clear that we are not, quote-unquote, a Christian nation. He actually said those words, and that we need to make America friendly, even for the non-believer. So in general, these worldviews are in a conflict, and Samuel Huntington's worldview is not succeeding. What does this mean for us? This orientation towards religious pluralism means that, in general, we have very little sense of national pride in our Christian past. We, like Europe, are so embarrassed, frankly, of being Christian because we think that if we say we're Christian and we talk about the fact that we are a Christian nation, and by the way, the only country in the whole world that doesn't know America is a Christian nation, is America. Everybody else in the world knows we're a Christian nation. I don't know if after 9/11 you watched any interviews of people in the Middle East. We were doing them constantly. Every one of them says, of course, America is a Christian nation. Everybody knows that, except us. As a result of this pluralism, we're taught to think that such celebration of our own religious identity and our own past is somehow prejudice against those who are not Christians. This is why the European Union, in its constitution, can reference the contribution of Plato, of the Greek philosophers, but cannot mention Christianity at all. There is no single mention in the European Union Constitution of its Christian past, even though Europe is a Christian creation and has absolutely no meaning apart from the fact of the Christian Church, which established Europe itself. It's just not tolerated to celebrate religious identity. If your goal is to think that all religions are equal, and we should all treat them exactly the same. We also find that our land is undergoing a very thorough and aggressive secularist attack upon the public expression of Christian faith. For at least a half a century, we have been aggressively chipping away at our Judeo-Christian roots in the law code itself. Just take California, for instance. You can start with the current insanity of homosexual marriage, which our state is locked in controversy over. We're anxiously awaiting the decision of our state Supreme Court on 6 lawsuits that they took under advisement after the passage of Proposition 8 to find out if they're going to be upholding Proposition 8 and accept the amendment of our Constitution to nullify the novel 3-month-old gay marriage decision of May 15th that our Supreme Court made. We don't know. How could a society get to the point where they are actually discussing in gay marriage, something that no society, literally I should say this slow because it's such a shocker, no society and no religion in the history of mankind has ever countenanced. Even the Greeks, the pagan Greeks, when they were worshipping dumb idols and they were permitting pedophilia and tolerating a large amount of homosexuality, never dreamed of calling that marriage and putting it on par between the union of a man and a woman. Only Western secularism has done that. That is the fruit of 50 years of growing insanity. And we could just go back. We can go back from 2008, where that decision happened. We can go back a little bit earlier to 1973, with the legalization of the murder of unborn children, abortion. You can go a little bit back before that to the decriminalization of adultery in the 60s, to the decriminalization of contraception in the 1930s. We have consistently been de-Christianizing our law code, especially on morals issues, little by little. I mean, I was shocked when I read a history, that it was a history of the LAPD and its vice squad, essentially. But, you know, we until the 60s, used to arrest people who were practicing sodomy in our state. And that wasn't anything unusual. That was normal Christian things to do. It wasn't until 2003, in the Supreme Court decision Lawrence versus Texas, that sodomy laws were negated and overthrown. All the California states had anti-sodomy laws. Why? Because all Christian civilizations in every place, going back to Emperor Constantine, have had sodomy laws. And why did they? Because the Bible teaches that sodomy is not just a sin, but a crime. We've gone through tremendous revolution in de-Christianizing our own law code so that now not only are all these crazy things like abortion and gay marriage legal, but on the opposite side, there is an attempt, a very aggressive attempt, to criminalize all moral opposition to these things under the category of hate speech.
Yeah.
This is a way that the whole movement has been reversed. The cloud of tolerance, which for 40 years has been thrown up to provide a cover for the radical alteration under the cover of the law code, once the law code is changed, believe me, that cloud is going to disappear, and the new laws, which express secular convictions, will be used as they are attempting to be used right now against people who have moral convictions against those sins. So here's a question for you. What is more scary, Sharia or secularist law? Which is law? Which is more scary, Sharia or secularist law? I don't think there's any quick answer to this question.
6.5 dozen.
I would feel very different about the Muslim request for Sharia law in the United States and in Western Europe if we had maintained some legal integrity, if the 80% of Christian society was actually exercising 80% of the influence amongst our political elites. And there was some expression of fidelity to the scriptures, and we were offering immigrants a Christian alternative, or at least an alternative that reflected the Christian faith of our nation. But we're not offering that. We're giving them a mess, an absolute mess that they know will not protect them, that they know will give legal sanction to immorality. And how can we expect that persons of traditional religious backgrounds would not want to be governed by their own laws? I don't know if I've ever, if I mentioned that here. Did I tell you about the gay pride parade in Moscow?
Oh, God.
No, actually, I want to
talk about this. What gay pride in Moscow?
I want to say about this. This will just shock you, and I think it will give you a sense of where we should be at on these important moral issues in our society. You know that since 1970, which is the date of the first gay pride parade in the history of mankind, which took place, by the way, not in San Francisco, but in Los Angeles, which has been the intellectual hub of the movement since that time. We identify San Francisco kind of as a hub, and it certainly is, but financially and intellectually, Los Angeles, Southern California, is the hub, especially through Hollywood. That first gay pride parade, which was in 1970, was no one respectable even walked in it. There was a 20-foot papier-mâché phallus drawn through the streets, which was a good symbol kind of the degradation of those who are participating in these things. Well, now there's gay pride parades all over the world. Sao Paulo, Brazil had 2 million people in their gay pride parade this year. Now in gay pride parades all over the United States, the Bank of America executives with their coats are walking, yes, you know, hello, this is all normal. Never mind the person in the drag dress over there, you know. Crazy days. So of course it's come now to Moscow. Last year, the very small gay community in Moscow demanded of the mayor of Moscow, who happens to be a practicing Orthodox Christian, that they have a gay pride parade. And the Moscow mayor said, over my dead body. And they said, we're going to take you to the international courts in The Hague. And he said,
go ahead.
They have no jurisdiction here. The great legal arm of the United Nations. And anyway, so at the same time that this was being requested and refused, one of our priests, God forgive him, decided that he was going to marry two homosexuals in one of our churches. And he did.
In Moscow?
He did, outside of Moscow.
Yeah.
Of course, we have no service for that, so he just made it up. I don't know if he just put man and man instead of, you know, husband and wife, but he did it. So, the patriarch decided, this was the patriarch Alexei, God rest his soul. He decided to go on to the television with the Grand Mufti, the head Muslim in Islam. They went on together. And they responded to the request for gay pride parade, and Patriarch Alexei said, you know, we're Christian people in this land, we're a Christian country, we don't do such things, we certainly don't glorify a lifestyle which is destructive to people, souls, we don't do that. We love people, and when you love persons, you don't help them sin, let alone gives a holy name to something that is so destructive to the human person. Then the Grand Mufti got on the television after him and said, I agree wholeheartedly with the Patriarch, and I have only one thing to add, that if there is a gay pride parade in Moscow, I cannot promise you that blood will not be shed. It was a good one-two punch, you know. The Christian-Muslim approach was quite clear. Anyway, the Patriarch didn't stop there, but he ordered a bulldozer the next day to go to the church where the marriage happened and bulldozed it out of existence. He doesn't exist. Why would he do such a thing? Obviously, normally we love and cherish our consecrated buildings, but he was more concerned that it would be, you know, the center, it would become the stone wall of Russia. You know, this is going to be a rallying point. This is going to be a place where somebody's going to say, this is where the first one happened. Well, now there is no this one.
Yeah.
There is no place. Oh, yes, of course. The priest was defrocked.
Didn't they bribe the priest to do the marriage?
Yeah, they did. Anyway, that might show you a traditional reaction compared to what we've been trained in our American society, our bogus and unloving tolerance of things that are very destructive to persons. So I'm not sure, actually, how to answer that question, which is more scary, Sharia or secularist law. In a matter of fact, There are many punishments in traditional Christian law codes that are very much closer to Sharia law. As a matter of fact, there's a good portion of Sharia law that was lifted directly from Byzantine law. So before we just throw off the idea that this is a really unreasonable request, we ought just think about that. What are we offering as an alternative? And why are we offering? Why is the Christian citizenship of America so compliantly cooperating with the radical secularization of our law codes? Why are we allowing this progressive secularization, which in fact might soon make us illegal? I want to finish my reflections and then have questions and answers by fleshing out from the Sharia, and I actually brought an English translation of one of the most famous Sunni editions of the Sharia, so you can see it. It's a dictionary of Islamic law. It reads from the right to the left, but you can find in it any subject. If you want to know about divorce, you just go to D and you'll find out what are the legal standards. This is kind of a help book for any Muslim who's trying to find an answer for a particular pressing question. So I'm going to pass that around for you to take a peek. What did life look like traditionally for Christians under these societies? First and foremost, Christians who were conquered by Muslims in the early centuries usually were left in place, at least for 50 to 75 years, if they were in large cities. Take, for instance, the conquering of Damascus, which happened in the early 7th century, not long after Muhammad's death. It wasn't until 706 that the Muslims actually removed the Christians in Damascus from places of power. Why did they do that? They did that because these were Bedouins coming up out of the Arabian Peninsula, conquering a very developed city that had large civil works projects, that had complicated tax systems. If they had thrown the Christians right out, what would have happened? Everything would have fallen to rubble. So they allowed the Christians to stay in place, those who were trained. This is why people like John of Damascus, St. John of Damascus, and his father and grandfather, were able to remain in power as civil governors and mayors of that city. In matter of fact, the reason that we know the date for the Islamicization of one of the markers for knowing the date of the Islamicization of Damascus was that was the year that John of Damascus went to the monastery in Palestine. He left his position because, in fact, Christians were asked to leave. Once that happened, Christians expressed their devotion to Islam, their willingness to live under Islamic authority by paying a tax. And that tax was something that Muhammad agreed could be paid by Christians and Muslims, and Christians and Jews, people of the book, in order to show their submission to Islam. If they paid the tax, they were supposed to be unmolested. So this is the first thing that you should know. There was a Quranic poll tax, the jizya. They also had many other taxes that were unique. They governed themselves in an ethnic, what's called the millet system, where the patriarch was put in charge of governing the Orthodox Christians, both politically and spiritually. Christians were required to carry a receipt of their tax payment wherever they were. It was something very important, like a visa. And when they were out in public, if they didn't have that, they could be required to pay more, or they were required to go home, or they weren't allowed to travel abroad. They had to carry that receipt with them. There was also a ceremony, I should tell you, of paying that tax, which is fairly consistent over the 14 years of Islam, and that is, when a Christian would pay the tax, he had to do it at the booth, at the tax booth, and he had to bow his head, and the Muslim tax collector, here, base, stand up, everybody. Not that I've ever done this to you, but the Muslim tax collector would just pop him in the back of the head like that. How's that look? That's how it works. Just a little sign to remind us who's boss. Who's boss? We also were required to wear distinctive dress. Usually this was a wide cloth belt here, but do not think that Adolf Hitler was the first one to invent distinctive dress for suppressed minorities. He took that from traditional Muslim practice with regards to Christians. Christians had to be able to be visually identified by their dress. He took a lot of other things from other places too. He learned a lot from our treatment of Indians with regards to the punishment of the Jews in Germany. So we had distinctive dress. We also were not greeted traditionally with the peace. We also were required to walk in certain areas and on the opposite side of the streets of Muslims in large cities. We were not allowed to construct buildings that were higher than the adjacent Muslim buildings. Our buildings had to be a little bit lower. We were not allowed to openly display wine, which is forbidden in Islam, pork, which is also forbidden, or the sign of the cross. A lot of our churches to this day in Islamic countries have no crosses atop them anymore. They've been torn off and they have not been permitted to be put up. We were not allowed to ring bells or to recite the Torah or the gospel out loud, not make public displays at funerals and feast days. We were not allowed to build new churches except by explicit permission of the caliph. And that usually went with a very steep fee. Kind of like having to go through the city planning department in Santa Barbara's bed. It was also a way to formally keep the law, but practically keep new churches from happening. And of course, new churches weren't supposed to be built because no Muslim is permitted to become a Christian. Apostasy is absolutely forbidden in Islam on pain of death. And don't think that that's just a, you know, something that's on the books that most Muslims don't believe in. Muslims are very faithful in believing that. I remember sitting in India with a young man who had been a Christian only 2 years and whose father attempted to murder him when he found out that he had become a Christian with a shovel in his backyard. He had run for his life, he had escaped, and he had not seen his family since. And that was not unusual. He didn't say, "Isn't this strange?" He said, "This is how it is for us. This is how it is. Apostasy is punishable by death. And therefore, there shouldn't be many people converting. Christians can take care of their own. They can maintain their buildings, but there's no need for them to build new ones." They also are not allowed to reside, traditionally not reside, for more than 3 days in Saudi Arabia, especially around the holy places of Medina and Mecca. Today, they're not even supposed to be there at all. Not even set their non-Muslim feet on that sand. I loved the late Patriarch Alexis, we're talking about him a lot today, comment to the King of Saudi Arabia, who last year wrote formally for a petition to build a mosque funded by Saudi Arabia in Moscow. And Patriarch Alexis wrote back very graciously, and he said, "Absolutely. Just let us build a church in Mecca first." Absolutely. He didn't have to say anything else. Take your hypocrisy home, please, and don't thwart it upon us. You don't let Christians have anything in your country, and you want to fund the creation of mosques all over the world. Of those 2,000 mosques here, 1,100, at least we know of, have been funded by Saudi Arabia. Lots of Saudi money coming to the United States to create houses of worship for Islam. But no Christian money allowed to go to Saudi Arabia. All protection was also forsaken to non-Muslims in Muslim countries. If they commit adultery with or marry a Muslim woman, which is strictly forbidden in Islam, Christian women can marry Muslim men, but Muslim women cannot marry Christian men. And to do so could mean your death. If you conceal a spy of hostile forces, this is a typical accusation for our priests, entertaining priests from other countries. Lots of our priests and our, even our patriarchs have been killed because they're accused of harboring spies because they're practicing hospitality, especially for clergy from other countries. If you kill a Muslim, if you lead any Muslim away from Islam, it's death. And if you mention anything impermissible about Allah or Muhammad, if any of you would read that wonderful book, The Neo-Martyrs of the Turkish Yoke, I think St. Vladimir's published it, I'm not positive, but it gives you a history, a 200-year history of Christian martyrs in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire. Many, I would say at least half, of the grounds for the execution of our people was because someone accused the Christian of saying something derogatory against Muhammad. And how do you defend that? If a Muslim in court says, "You said it, that's done, you're done. You're done." There's no way that a judge is going to judge for the Christian against the Muslim in a case like that. You also have an exclusion from public office and from the military as a Christian, unless you were captured for 300 years, especially in what is now Serbia. The Ottomans captured young men to fill their janissary corps, their really hardcore Muslim shock troops, were stolen children from Christian villages, who were then converted forcibly to Islam and made their chief warriors. Christians had an inequality before the law. Muslims had virtual immunity in interfaith litigation. I have a quote here from one of the French consuls in the Ottoman Empire, and this is the 19th century. He says this quote, "It will always be impossible to prove that a Turk is a false witness, and a Turk will never give evidence against another Turk in favor of a Christian. That is their custom, that is their constant practice. We French are regarded as infidels whose testimony should not be recognized in law." This affects everything, of course, including the exchange of prisoners. Traditional Muslim society does not do an equal prisoner exchange because Muslim blood is more valuable than Christian blood. Therefore, if you're going to give back, you know, two Christians, you better have four Muslims that are coming back. In their mind, that's equality. Initially, in most of our large cities, 50% of the Christian churches were converted immediately to mosques. And even those that were promised tolerance, gradually, with the passage of time, most of those were converted into mosques. I just came back in January from a trip to Istanbul. And I read a number of interesting books, dissertation from Turkish universities about what happened to the churches after the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. And it was sad to watch. The Constantinople was full of hundreds of churches, hundreds of churches. So even if we give the 50% rule to Constantinople, that 50% became mosques right away, you would still expect there to be 50% of the churches in existence. And especially in so-called secular Turkey, you might think that they would uphold that. Today there are just a handful of churches. And the Ecumenical Patriarch is a little tiny piece of land. The church is really pathetic. The great church, you know, we still call the Ecumenical Patriarch. But life in the Ottoman Empire over time has meant the gradual eclipse of Christianity, so that we have just several thousand left in the city of Constantinople today. Christian cemeteries had to be different than Muslim cemeteries and were often desecrated. This is a quote from the famous Jewish female scholar and French scholar, Bat Yeor, who has given her professional career to the study of Christians, especially under Islam, for the last 14 centuries. She's published three very significant manuscripts on the subject, bringing to light the life of Eastern Christians under Islam. And this is a quote from her. "The whole history of the Islamic conquests is punctuated with forced conversions," unquote. The whole history is punctuated with forced conversions. We also have special housing areas, and many of those housing areas often had no public services whatsoever. We were required to not ride on horseback. That was considered too dignified for Christians. Sometimes, if we were passing by and a Muslim was coming this way, and you were on a donkey, you had to get off your donkey, you had to put your head down. Christian quarters, the Christian quarter, today you can still see this in many places in Muslim countries. There's a Christian area, and the floor of the businesses of the Christians are 2 or 3 feet below ground, so that if a Muslim is negotiating something, he's looking down on the Christian. Very important. Physical gestures that were required of Christians, etc. Do we have precedent for the idea of a union of democracy, Western political values, and Sharia and Islam itself? Many Muslims, especially Muslims in America, are suggesting to us that this reconciliation is possible. Of course, that's an important question for them to ask, because at heart of that question is, will the Muslims who have made America their home and have become American citizens really be able to integrate their faith with American principles? That's what's really behind that question. Can democracy and Islam unify? Before I tell you the answer, what I think is the answer, I should quote Dr. Murtada Khan. He's the chair of the Department of Political Science at Adrian College in Michigan. And he's also a fellow of the Center of the Study of Islam and Democracy. This is what he says about Sharia. He says, "Sharia is of the essence of Islam, and Sharia is decidedly democratic. The reason for Islam's great record of tolerance and pluralism in the past is the correct understanding and application of the Sharia." So you would think if the Sharia is traditionally democratic, that you would be able to see in the 14th centuries of the application of Sharia in Muslim countries, the creation of democratic societies. In fact, there are no such things. Democracy has never been the product of any Muslim land. Most commonly cited today are the so-called secular republics of Turkey and Pakistan. For any of you who have traveled in those countries, if those are the best examples of tolerance and pluralism and union with democratic principles that Islam has to offer, we are in very deep trouble. We are in very deep trouble. I remember I spent a summer in Pakistan in 1987, mostly in a little town called Peshawar, which is on the Afghani-Pakistan border. It was the place that Osama bin Laden was living in 1987. Little did I know that. I found that out and my hair went up on my head. But it shocked me even more to learn, of course, that he was living there supported by American money and our soldiers who were training him to fight the Russians, who had the Soviets who had come down into Afghanistan. But while I was in Pakistan, I remember being deeply impressed that this supposed democracy had absolutely no tolerance for Christians whatsoever. The very small number of Christians in that country, in that city, I remember being pointed out, there's a torture chamber for Christians, there's a torture chamber for Christians, there's a torture chamber for Christians. And most of the Christians that were allowed to stay in the society, at least in the 1980s, were associated with very tangible, practical ministries. They were doctors working at hospitals. The Christians ran the medical field in Pakistan. They were allowed there because if they had kicked all the Christians out, their medical industry would have just crashed. If Pakistan and Turkey, which has driven Christians in the 20th century since being secularized, has driven Christians almost completely out of the country. If those are the best examples of societies where Islam is going to unite with Western values and tolerance for Christians, then I think we have a very unhopeful future, that Sharia law could be embraced and find a place for us. So we should know we have several options before us. We have the aggressive statism and secularism, which of course is going to morph into even greater power because of the current radical increase in state authority and power that's taking place under President Obama. The authority and size of the state is being increased in a way that has never happened in the history of America. So if you combine an aggressive secularist law with a really powerful aggressive state, we may find that we're in a very uncomfortable position. Another alternative, of course, is to let religious communities express their faith and have laws that are directly rooted in their religion. I don't think as long as we embrace secularism we can say much to them. And we know what it's like to live as a Dhimmi people in Dhimmitude under Islamic domination. And perhaps a third option is for us to awaken and to, in love of God, desire and ask that our elected representatives support legislation that reflects the tradition of our faith, that the Ten Commandments be respected and honored and not thrown out. We should just tell the politicians, please respect the Ten Commandments or we're going to throw you out. That would be better, I think. We may be past that. We may not have any more time to do such things. But perhaps suffering a bit as we are now and being scared in our own country that we might have to somehow be quiet about what we really believe, which is very hard for an American to do. We're not used to that at all, having to talk quiet. Maybe that pain will help us to renew our love for God. And if you love God, you want to see His name glorified, and you want to see beautiful His teachings beautifully embraced by society and supported by society. I'll stop there. I hope we're strong enough for that. I really do. Do we have a few minutes, Mother? We can.
Let's take it.
I bore you?
No.
No.
Did you scare us? What if a Christian and a Muslim have a conflict? Who is their court they go to?
Well, right now it hasn't changed. Remember, these are just requests that are coming from the Muslim community. So right now we're still governed by America's courts. Of course, those courts are very different. Those courts are finding all sorts of legal precedents that no previous lawyers and judges knew existed. So we're in a very uncertain realm with regards to what the decisions of our own American courts are. And even in those countries in Western Europe, like in Britain, where Sharia courts have some foothold, those are only for the Muslim community. So if there's a conflict that's involving a Muslim and a non-Muslim citizen of those countries, they're still mediated over by the country's courts. So this is allowing some sort of internal governance, very similar, to, in fact, to what the Muslims did in their millet system. This is allowing some measure of internal self-government. Of course, if that continues to grow, and if the influence continues to grow, it won't stop there. We have no reason to believe that the Muslim longing for the whole world, of course, to be the house of Islam and to be under the Sharia is going to change. They'll be happy when we are all following those laws.
And is it common practice today that the Muslims have the Quranic prayer where they take their own mats and they get, like,
oh, of course,
some employees get smoky breaks?
Oh, absolutely.
Where they get their prayer breaks?
When I was in, I was telling you about my time in Pakistan, I used to be on the trains, and even if it was the time of, I remember being asked by a man to get up because he wanted to put his mat on my seat so he could do his prayers. Absolutely, you know, forgive me for being in your way, but absolutely. The hours of prayer are public, very public.
It just seems to me that there's a coming clash, though, between this radical sex workers and Sharia. I mean, they're the ones that are supporting this under the name of democracy. They're going to run smack dab somewhere into a big crash.
For sure.
That's what happened in Europe.
Oh, I think so, absolutely, and the sooner the better, personally.
Yeah.
I think we have far more in common with Sharia law than we have with secular law, and that we, in fact, could have a good cooperation now with the Muslim community on areas where the secular state is really pressing all traditional religious people. Orthodox Jews, traditional Muslims, and Orthodox Christians have a lot in common, especially on areas of morality. So, for instance, this gay marriage thing. I mean, I went to the mosque in my town, and I asked, his name is Dr. Mustafa Kuko, who's the spiritual director of the Islamic Academy there. I asked him, I said, can't we do something together about this? I think it's important, one, to take the accusation of the secularists away from them that this is a Christian issue. It's not a Christian issue. I wrote a letter to our editor in our Riverside Press Enterprise, in which I said to them, I said, look, because they came, as did every single newspaper in California, without exception, formally opposed Proposition 8. How is that possible? Every single one did. And when they did that, the next week I wrote this article and I said, look, you are asking us to be radical cultural iconoclasts. You are asking us to do, this is not a Christian issue, and it's not a Jewish issue, it's not a Muslim issue. This is a civilization issue, and this is a religion issue. No religion in the history of humankind has ever blessed homoerotic activity. None. It does not exist. And you're asking us to just, because a few, you know, elites in our country want this, that we're just going to throw off the entire history of civilization for you? I said, you're nuts. You're nuts. But the Muslims would not cooperate. When I asked him for the cooperation, I mean, it was a friendly refusal, but he said, you know, we're very nervous about this. We're very, very nervous about this. He said, I met with my counsel, and he goes, usually I never meet with them. I make the decision and I tell them. On this subject, I met with them. I said, what do you want to do? And he said, it was completely divided. Because they were afraid. They feel like they already have a hard enough time in America. They're already viewed under enough suspicion that to enter this, and now to get the ire of the homosexuals against them, who are such a powerful lobby, in our country, who have such aggressive goals, they didn't want to do it. So we were able to cooperate with the Mormons and with the Catholics and the Evangelicals. Those bodies came together, but not really the Jews or the Muslims.
But some Christians in this country who are supporting the liberal agenda right now, the part of Christianity that they value is the freedom. And they're going to look to us for help in supporting that freedom against this. And it's going to be, I mean, the history of where this is going to go is just, who knows, you know, because it's just not going to stay the same.
No, absolutely. The culture is changing. I feel as a pastor, I can't keep up. I mean, our goal as priests is to help our people to be able to live faithfully for God and to face the things that they're facing successfully. But the things that they're facing are changing so quickly that we really do not have time to study up on all of the challenges before our people actually are. I mean, just take the realm of medicine, let alone secular law. The changes that are going on in medicine and what our people can and can't do based upon development of technology is running so fast. I mean, just take a subset, take fertility. There are so many new medical inventions with regards to fertility that need a moral evaluation. We just haven't had time to do it. Society is changing extremely quickly.
How many Christian organizations do you have in the United States? 3,000? This information which one I found like a month ago. 3,000 Christian organizations, which one is confused me. Okay, I'm born in Orthodoxy and I only experienced Orthodoxy and not only I learned Orthodoxy, sure. And only then I emigrated in the United States and found so many just about for my knowledge, the Christian organization, which way they're practicing, how sure. They're practicing, what sure. They're looking, which faith they're doing. Mm. Still today, you know. Mm.
Right.
And I just said, all this, what you've got, beautiful speech. I have experience because I'm from the Serbian part where we have a 500 years, you know, the Turkish Imperium us. Anybody knows anything I speak with my friends, with my co-worker, only thing they look at me like I'm the one who hate everybody. Like Orthodox, they ask me, is I Muslim? It's so much knowledge, so much a high education about Orthodox Christian in this country. I was so surprised. That's not surprising me. Nothing was going on, even if I was first time to vote in my life for this Proposition 8. I didn't want to go past. I have a daughter who is 18 years. I think about these young lives and our faith. And I'm not surprising me anything about this, our democracy government who attack us, Orthodox Christian, also the Clinton and Bush and everyone. It's very similar with all this your speech to this about the secta and Muslim and really are speeches. And it's good to be only to pray and stay in our strong faith and Orthodox way, not to listen to so many other Christian religion, which one is calling religion, because I'm considering myself a believer,
sure.
Not religion. And I don't know, but what's going to happen? Maybe you have a better answer for us to tell them something more, because but it's really scary time.
It is a scary time. And it's a time for us to grow in our love for God. You know, when you're under a trial and when you're tested, this is the opportunity to show your quality. It's an opportunity to develop quality. So please don't take anything that I said as a reason to be scared in the sense of, anxious, sinfully anxious. We don't have anything to worry about as far as that goes.
No.
We don't have anything to worry about that. The Lord is the victor. He is the King of Kings, and He loves His church, and He loves you, and He's going to take care of His people. The question is what are we going to remain faithful when it's not easy to be faithful? And what can we do to contribute to the glory of God in our own society? If you're like me, I have this sense in my heart that a lot of this mess has happened because we as a people have been more interested in our own pleasures than we have been in glorifying God in society. I fear that that's why this has happened. It's like a vacuum.
Yeah.
We just gave over society and responsible contribution to society. We just gave it over. We said, I'm not interested in doing anything like that for God. Remember, these are traditionally holy areas, medicine and law. The three professions that are traditional in Christian society is the clergy, medicine, and law. Why are these three things so revered? They're so revered because of the direct connection to the Lord. Oh, the clergy are obvious, right? Given by as love gifts from Christ to us to minister to our souls and bring us to paradise. Lawyers were those who had the great honor of holding the law of God and upholding it in society and teaching it and applying it to society. And doctors were those who were able to cooperate with the merciful God in the healing of persons' bodies and souls. So those three areas are the traditional professions, and we have allowed them to be co-opted by a different vision. So now medicine is perhaps the scariest area, ethically. It's the most compromised area ethically. And law is not far behind it, where we Christians need to reassert our love for God and make positive contributions and take back that. if it's true, and Samuel Huntington shows you the statistics of a thousand ways, that 80% of America self-identify as Christians, I don't think that's a hopeless condition. Obviously, that self-identification doesn't have much content. You know, it's an idea. But that's still hopeful. Is Mother wanting to cut it off? But Tara's giving me that. Are we much over time?
So it's 5:30.
Oh, we're way over time.
5 more minutes?
Yes. The Abbess has spoken. So there's 5 more minutes. So you have 1 minute and 1 minute.
I grew up, when I was young, I grew up in Algeria with my my folks. And my father is my father's Protestant. He's an Islamophile. He got his degree in Islamic studies at UCLA. And I grew up basically kind of split between, you know, orthodoxy and tolerance for Islam, and we're all the same, it's all the same God, you know, that kind of thing. And having to bridge the gap between what I believe and then dealing with someone who is very, shall we say, tolerant of Islam, but not too tolerant of traditional Christianity. So how would I go about
reconciling those two?
Defending my faith in a way that's not obnoxious towards my dad. You know?
Be a good Orthodox Christian. You know, brothers and sisters, for a long time, for centuries, we've tried to send missionaries to Muslim lands, mm-hmm. not very successfully. What a great opportunity today, they're all coming to our land. You know, we used to give immigrants a copy of the New Testament. That was standard American policy. I'm not talking about in the 17th century. I'm talking about the middle of the 20th century. Someone came to America, we taught them about our country's history, we gave them a copy of the New Testament, we said this is the most important book you're going to need to know when you come to America. We don't do that anymore. We should do that. We should do that. You don't need a government to do that.
Absolutely.
We should give New Testaments to our Muslim neighbors. We should welcome them and say, bless God, you're here. If I was a Muslim living there, I'd come here too. This is a fantastic idea.
And it's a good idea.
Really love them and maybe lay our debt lives down for them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a good thing to do with regards to them.
Read it. One of the things I hear you saying is that whether it be the secularist movement or the Sharia law, there may come a day not too far out where we cannot work, that the light or the dark will make it difficult to do things like be involved in politics or to build churches or things along those lines. So, is it a time, and if Jesus' words work while there's still light, while it's still day, the night comes and no man can work. In what way might that be applicable?
I don't think that his words flee to the mountains apply to us right now. I think we got in this mess because we fled to the mountains. And remember, all of these things I'm telling you, they're shockers to us because they're new to our country. So we're in complete shock. I mean, our heads are spinning. That doesn't mean that America's heart is somehow overrun by these things. I don't think so. I'm not that pessimistic at all. I think that they're, I mean, take my county, Riverside County. This is Southern California. Granted, it's Riverside. And Riverside is, you know, the most traditional kind of Christian county in California. We went for Proposition 8 by 91%.
All right.
91%. Come on! There's 400 churches in my little town. You know, our mayor and our city council are very supportive of churches and want clergy involved. That's just where I am. So, I mean, we have one small mosque. I mean, they're not a threat to us. They're not a threat to us. Not, the threat is secularism and our California legislature.
Yes.
If I had to put my finger on one area, I would say vote out of office. Well, first, find out what your representative in the state legislature is voting for. Mm-hmm. And probably 90% chance they're voting for everything you don't believe in. Mm-hmm. Throw them out. They wanted Harvey Milk Day. They wanted a $4 billion renovation of our public school curriculum to show the contributions of homosexuals, bisexuals, and transgender persons. They voted against abortion restrictions. They voted formally against Proposition 8. How can we have people in the legislature, which is a representative body, doing that to us?
Yeah.
So I would look there.
That's right, because they're going to tell them us.
Just say, you know, thanks a lot, you served your time.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Hello there.
Yeah, hi.
From the gallery.
An argument that seems to defeat a lot of the Christians that are speaking up against secularism is that secularism says, well, there's separation of church and state, you have no voice here.
Sure.
That's a reinterpretation of what it initially meant, but I think we Christians don't really understand what is meant by separation of church and state, so mm-hmm. we're quiet, because we think we're supposed to be quiet based on that principle.
Sure.
How should we interpret that understanding of separation of church and state in a more proper Christian way that you say that the Muslims are not interpreting it that way? Should we do away with separation of church and state, or should we reinterpret it back to a different...
Well, if you're asking me what I would want, that's one thing. If you're asking me how we should talk to America, I think that's a completely different thing. Traditional separation of church and state, which exists in America, it does not mean the separation of religion from public policy. It means that no one Protestant denomination is going to be formally the state church. So when the colonies were organizing, those colonies were divided very much along religious lines. Episcopalians were in Virginia, and in Massachusetts were the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists, and the Founding Fathers didn't want one of those sects to become dominant in our country. This is the separation of church and state, no formal endorsement, unlike England from where they came, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that religion is not supposed to be the guiding light. All of our Founding Fathers and about 150 years of Supreme Court justices and rulers were very clear that Christianity is the light of America.
Yeah.
I think reiterating those is great, and giving a definition of the separation of authority, I mean, the separation of realms with a common authority being God and His Word is the way that we should teach people to think about it. But I'd like to have a nice, pious, believing king. Sorry about that. Anyway, thank you very much. I shouldn't take any more time, but thank you for your listening. Another thank you for having me.
Thank you for your visit.
We hope that you have enjoyed and have been edified by this presentation offered to you by Patristic Nectar Publications, a nonprofit organization committed to nourishing the spiritually thirsty with the sweet teachings of the Holy Fathers. If you are interested in other available titles, or if you would like more information on Patristic Nectar Publications, please visit our website at www.patristicnectar.org. Again, that's www.patristicnectar.org.